You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode 253 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast, sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Caracino.
And we are coming to you as usual from different locations. I'm in Boulevard Park, Washington, home of the Pelton Cast.
I'm coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks.
Home of no signings in the first 24 hours of legal tampering period, but they made some deals, moves finally, and we will talk about those in a bit. But first, by the way, it's the South Sound edition of the Pelton Cast. We're going to talk about that too. Episode 253, shout out that area code. We got a lot to get to, so let's get right into our beer, which is from our friends at Fremont Brewing. We haven't been to Fremont for a little bit here, but got a couple weeks worth of beers here. The Revelation IPA from Fremont.
Why do I want to read this in U2 voice? And call it Relevation.
Let's see here. We've got Simcoe Sabro, Idaho 7, Mosaic, and Sirachi Ace hops in this. The IBU is apparently just the right amount, which I didn't know was a thing. Aroma is mango with other tropical notes, orange followed by stone fruit and woody notes, and the flavor is moderately sweet and mildly bitter. Both linger, medium body and carbonation.
The description of this beer is like me giving a take. They just said all different perspectives, and eventually one will hit, and then they'll claim that it's right. If you taste some woodiness, that's right. If you taste some sweetness, that's right. If you taste some bitterness, you're good there too.
I would say
Relevation!
Your takes do have a tendency to linger. Oh, boy. All right, as we get to our toasts, a reminder to sign up now for the Pelton Cast Bracket Challenges returning for the men's and women's NCAA tournaments. We are at literally ones of the listener in each of these bracket pools.
That's not me.
Yeah, you need to join at some point here. You have until Friday morning because the NCAA tournament officially starts on Friday. The first four games will be Thursday night before the action tips off in Indianapolis, and then the women's tournament tipping off on Sunday.
Okay.
So, well, we kind of alluded to this last week as a possibility, but shortly thereafter, after we recorded last week, Washington Governor Jay Inslee announced that fans will be allowed for outdoor sports at up to 25% capacity or a maximum of 9,000 people. The Mariners immediately announced plans to have fans at T-Mobile Park on opening day, April 1st. Still haven't yet heard Sounders FC's plans, but they have a little more time to announce it as they don't begin their season until mid-April, as we'll talk about in a bit here. So, exciting step in our return towards normalcy, even if this remains a kind of important inflection point in the pandemic is we rapidly vaccinate people, but also deal with the effects of variants.
I'm not willing to consider that a toast. Fans at sporting events in Seattle.
I mean, as we talked about last week, outdoor sports, it does generally seem to be pretty safe, presuming that everyone remains masked. And the masking that we've seen in the Seattle area has been very good. It's not like what it looks like on TV sometimes.
Uh-huh. SEC football. This is not the SEC football level.
The SEC basketball tournament was not. It was not great. Not great watching that last weekend.
Shocking. I doubt they're required for some of these games, I'm not opposed to it happening. I'm just saying that's not something that I'm toasting to.
Fair. Speaking of the vaccination process, our friends at Seattle Restaurants United are pushing for clarity around vaccination access for restaurant workers who are not among the essential workers who will become eligible for vaccination on Wednesday, which include grocery store workers and others on the front line. To add your support for restaurant workers getting the vaccine, visit bit.ly/vaxrest, R-E-S-T, work. Since you're probably not going to memorize it, that link is also on the post note on soniccentral.com, and we'll post it from the Pelton Cast Twitter account. But, you know, obviously food is a big part of what we do here, and we want to make sure that we let chefs cook safely.
There we go. You know what, Jay? Stop worrying about fans and sporting events and the income that comes with that, and get these restaurant workers vaccinated right now.
I mean, it's definitely important work that they're doing, providing food for all of us during the pandemic, and we want to make sure they're safely able to do it.
I think about it every time I go to the Pagliacci or whatever, right? Any location, that there are people there working for 8 hours a day, having to be masked the entire time. Well, they are working, getting hot in these kitchens, and they were there through all points of the pandemic. They were there in March 2020, all the way through March 2021, when they were capable of doing so. They should be one of the first groups getting vaccinated in Washington State.
For sure. And I mean, we don't want to take anything away from the rest of these essential workers, but definitely restaurant workers deserve a spot in line too. This week, we're remembering longtime Seahawks assistant coach Rusty Tillman, who died Sunday at age 75. Tillman was the Seahawks special teams coordinator from 1979 through 91, the first position coach full-time, I think, to coach special teams for the Seahawks, and then also held position coach responsibilities on both offense and defense before being elevated to defensive coordinator in 1992 under Tom Flores. The Seahawks finished third in defensive DVOA in Tillman's first season in that role, which was Cortez Kennedy's Defensive Player of the Year season, and remained an above-average defense all three of his seasons as defensive coordinator. Some sort of somewhere between good and bad news. Jordan Morris had ACL surgery last Thursday, so the comeback is officially on. The rehab process starting as he works back from that second ACL injury. And of course, we once again wish Jordan Morris good luck in getting back on the pitch as soon as possible. Lastly this week, Storm forward Morgan Tuck announced her medical retirement after dealing with persistent knee injuries. Tuck said in the Storm's statement that, quote, I have to listen to, or in her statement, I guess, I have to listen to what my body's telling me. She played 10 games for the Storm in 2020 after being acquired via trade and won her lone WNBA championship last year to go with four titles, one at UConn alongside Storm teammate Brianna Stewart.
There we go. Going out on top.
Yeah. Okay. It's the South Sound edition, and I wanted to go over who is the best athlete from the 253 area code and
for first, episode 253 of the Pelton Cast.
Correct.
Just and, wait till we get to the 425.
Oh yeah, I was saying, I don't think we're doing 509 though.
We're not gonna do 509.
And we're really pretty kind of Western Washington only on the pod.
Look, who knows what it'll be like in 2026 or whatever year we get to episode 509. This, we might have expanded our small footprint from just Western Washington to all of Washington State.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. That assumes that we somehow have a footprint in Western Washington.
Anything is possible.
So the 253 area code is much larger than I realized. I didn't realize that Kent was part of it. I probably knew that at some point when I knew people who lived in Kent specifically, and when you dialed phone numbers, which is a thing we don't do anymore. So it's a long list. We'll start with
you went very, very deep opening up these notes with how many athletes you have from the 253 area code. I was brainstorming and I was at like four.
I went through a lot of Wikipedia, went through some of the sports reference sites to try to make sure I got everyone. And this is not supposed to be a comprehensive list, but players of note and of interest to us specifically, I think, are particularly highlighted. So let's start with men's basketball. I mean, Isaiah Thomas, obviously one of the first people that comes to mind. People talk about him as part of this group of Seattle players, and he is in a larger national sense. But Isaiah also very quick to say he's from Tacoma, not from Seattle. Mm-hmm. Avery Bradley, another current NBA player. Malachi Flynn, just drafted in the first round this year out of Wazoo. CJ Ellaby from our Blazers.
Blazers legend, CJ Ellaby.
Abdul Gaddy, once upon a time, I think Avery Bradley's teammate and at the prep level. Rodney Stuckey from Kent. Michael Dickerson from Federal Way. The McDaniels brothers, Jaden and Jalen. And Brian Scalabrine, of course. Highland Community College legend. But before that, I believe Enumclaw High School legend.
There we go.
All right, football. When people talk about UW like putting a fence around the state of Washington in recruiting, they actually mean putting a fence around the 253.
Wow.
Because it is just a startling number of Husky legends from the Tacoma/Lakes area. A number, I think, of families affiliated with McCord Air Force, Joint Base Lewis-McChord, should say. So It's a long list here. Lawyer Malloy, the True Fonts, the Hewards, not from those particular areas, but also from the 253 from Puyallup, and Brock Heward's high school teammate and college teammate, Dane Looker. Of course, Jermaine Kearse, undoubtedly one of the first 253 players to come to mind when you think about this. Zach Banner, Reggie Williams, legendary Husky kicker Jeff Jaeger. Ahmad Rashad, I had forgotten, is from Tacoma.
I did not know that.
That's where he went to high school, at Mount Tahoma. Billy Joe Hobart, mixed legacy at UW.
When Ernie, him and Ahmad Rashad, yes.
Ahmad Rashad has a mixed legacy at
not at UW, but for going to Oregon.
Yes. Who knows how well he was recruited at that point. Ernie Conwell, Austin Safarian Jenkins, Caleb McGarry, Danny Shelton, John Kitna, 90s linebacker and what briefly Seahawk, Hillary Butler, Chad Eaton, another who played for the Seahawks, Omari Lowe, and also Hall of Famer from the 1930s, Red Badgero. Wow. I'm sure you remember it well.
You went deep. What about the lineman who's from, oh my God, not Edmonds Woodway. That's the other direction. Foster Serrell.
Is Foster Serrell from the 253?
He's from the two cities that are together.
Oh, I guess he is. Yes, you're right. He is. He did not come up in my search.
I can't think of the two. It's the place that I got lost one night on
Graham
Thanksgiving.
And Kapausen.
Graham Kapausen, yes. Foster Serrell is from Graham Kapausen.
I even went to the Graham Wikipedia page. Wow. And he wasn't on there. Come on, Graham Wikipedia page. Get it together.
And then also Stanford player person who committed to Stanford, who was snowboarding in their commitment video. Current star at Stanford.
Snowboarding in their commitment video.
They committed to UW, I believe, originally, and then transferred to, and then maybe recommitted to Stanford. We'll come. I thought that maybe they were from the 253 also.
Boy, I do not know who you are referencing here. Not finding anyone. They're not currently on the roster, are they?
I thought they were this year.
Not seeing it. All right, baseball. Mike Blowers from Spanaway. Ron Say, all-star third baseman. John Lester, I had forgotten that he was from Tacoma. And go back to the 1930s and 40s. Yes. Eight-time all-star Bob Johnson.
There we go.
Legend. Soccer, we've got Marcus Hahnemann, who played for the Sounders both in the USL, or at the point in the A-League, I think, and in MLS, played in Europe, and now is on the broadcast, I think. Women's basketball, Kate Starbird. People forget what a legend Kate Starbird was. Yes. And now doing great work. She works on like Twitter and social media and kind of how to use that in emergency situations. So as a professor at UW.
Oh, really?
Yep. And then Courtney Vandersloot, WNBA All-Star, assist leader from Kentwood. Also from Kent Volleyball, Courtney Thompson, a legend at UW. One of the handful of retired jerseys at UW, I think, right? MMA, Misha Tate.
I like that you confirm that with me as if I would know.
And swimming, we have Megan Gendrick, nay Kwan, Olympic medalist. Golf, Ryan Moore. Auto racing, Derek Cope and Casey Kane. Track and field, Doris Brown Heritage, better known, I think, as the track coach at SPU after running there. And then I think we come to the two actual winners of this.
Really?
Even though they may not be as near and dear to our hearts as Isaiah Thomas and Jermaine Kearse. First off, legendary athlete. Really one of the most athletic people you can imagine. Bowler Earl Anthony.
There we go.
But Earl Anthony is like the bowler. So
is he really?
He's a pretty big deal. He's a very big deal. And then from the world of speed skating, Federal Way's Apollo Ohno, I think, has to be considered the best athlete from the 253.
Connor Weddington is who I was thinking of. From Sumner, so I would assume that's the 253.
That is, yes.
Man, it's a tough one because you're not really competing on level playing fields here, right? Speed skating and bowling vis-a-vis professional basketball and football. You know what I mean? Like, Jermaine Kearse is literally scoring touchdowns in the Super Bowl, which is basically the greatest thing that you can achieve as a professional athlete, right?
But the greatest thing you can achieve as an individual athlete is to win a gold medal in the Olympics. Apollo Ohno was a big fucking deal. By the way, clearly it's not Jermaine Kearse isn't the best football player from the 253.
Who do you consider the best? Lawyer Malloy?
I would say it's either Lawyer Malloy or I'd have to do more research and double check on how good Ahmad Rashad was. But he was pretty good.
Lawyer Malloy also a Super Bowl winner. You know, like, man, that is a really tough one.
We'll have to put this to the listener.
I feel like Apollo Ono is probably on a Wheaties box.
That's the standard.
I'm not 100% sure. I'm pretty confident that Apollo Anton Ono is on a Wheaties box.
He is,
also,
yes.
The only
cover of SI.
The only speed skater that I'm familiar with. And also, I mean, what Olympics was he in? 2004?
I think there were multiple, I assume.
Okay.
Lawyer Malloy has also been on a Wheaties box, for the record.
Really?
Yeah, when they were the Super Bowl champions, they highlighted five players here on the back front from their 2000. This was the 2001 team. Can you guess who those five players were?
Oh my God! Why do you have to do this to me? Well, Brady.
Oh, that's great. Yes, Brady is correct.
Oh man, Teddy Bruschi, was he on?
No.
Willie McGinnis?
No, you will never get two of these players. One you have a chance at getting.
They didn't have Curtis Martin still. No, this is way after Curtis Martin, right? Yes.
I mean, that was Pete Carroll, who was heartbroken about losing Curtis Martin to the Jets.
Oh man. We'll see what happens with Chris Carson.
Yeah. I give it away.
What were you saying? Terry Glenn?
Oh, you didn't hear it. Okay. No, Terry Glenn. No, long gone by that point.
I got nothing.
Troy Brown was the one you plausibly could have gotten.
Was Vinatieri on one?
No, Vinatieri was not. I don't know why not. The other two players who were highlighted were running back Antoine Smith and Roman Pfeiffer.
Yeah, I was definitely not coming up with those ones.
No, you weren't.
But Lawyer Malloy chosen. So Lawyer Malloy not only won a Super Bowl, he was chosen as one of five players, a handful of whom have faded into obscurity.
I mean, he definitely was one of the best players. I would assume he was a defensive captain on that team.
It's an interesting conversation between those two.
But Isaiah Thomas was a better basketball player than Lawyer Malloy was a football player.
Are you convinced of that?
I think so.
How many Pro Bowls did Lawyer Malloy go to? Isaiah Thomas probably had a season that was better than any of Lawyer Malloy's season.
But yeah, I guess so. Four-time Pro Bowler, one-time first-team All-Pro, one-time second-team All-Pro.
But also in our hearts, we know who the answer is.
Cold
there's no Ono crew, right?
Oh, well, that's true. Yes.
There's only one curse crew. There's only one player who I think might have been elected into the Pelton Cast Hall of Fame. No one knows. We completely forgot after we did that. I'll give you Apollo Ono, but you have to at least give an honorable mention to curse here.
For sure. I mean, we're coming back to the Pelton Cast Hall of Fame. We just have not had the break that we expected, I think, in our coverage this time of year.
We did it in like May last year?
We did in March. We did it right after the pandemic started.
Did we really?
Yeah, we're coming up on it, the anniversary of it. Should we start out by talking about the Seahawks?
Sure.
So there was good news and bad news from the last couple of days.
Really?
The good news is it doesn't look like they're trading Russell Wilson.
Okay.
I mean, obviously we did not think they were trading Russell Wilson. We talked about there being a 5% chance of that, but now I think it's even lower than that. After the Bears, according to Adam Schefter's reporting, made a push for Russell Wilson and a very aggressive pursuit, according to Adam Schefter's sources, but we're told that Seattle is not trading him at this time. And of course they pivoted to the next best thing, which is Andy Dalton.
I mean, what are you going to do if you're the Bears, right? I guess you have to have some quarterback. I feel like they might have just been better off waiting that one out. But when you do look at the teams that were on Russell Wilson's list, which, to be clear, this was it was a list that was tweeted or whatever, but like there could still be teams that he was interested in playing for. I wouldn't say that this is it. If one of these four teams won't have him, something changes. Russell Wilson could go to any of the other 27 teams in the NFL, but when you look at the Cowboys re-upping Dak Prescott, you look at the Bears, who clearly were rejected by this last minute push. You look at the Saints and their handful of very expensive quarterbacks now. Some even as expensive as Russell
Wilson. On paper, expensive quarterbacks.
but still tough. It would be virtually impossible for them to figure out how to get Russell Wilson financially. And then also, yes, the Raiders' offensive line has been decimated. So
it's in shambles.
The entire reason that he wanted to go to the Raiders is basically over. And then all of a sudden you're reunited with Tom Cable and no talent. So a destination is a really hard thing to find there. Also, quarterbacks like Russell Wilson don't get traded in their prime very often. It is a very uncommon scenario that happens. I mean, we have a quarterback in Houston who has actively demanded a trade, and I also don't see that happening. So
the Tyrod Taylor signing was a bit suspicious.
I guess so. Tyrod Taylor, though?
It was a lot of money to pay if you're just thinking of having him as your backup to Deshaun Watson.
Sure. But it's a rare scenario that something like this happens at this time. And I think you have to credit the Seahawks for not panicking, for not pivoting instantly, right? And we kind of heard it from Mike Sean. We were anticipating that this would be the case. And also, if we are to take what Mike Sean said to us a couple of weeks ago, maybe next year, next offseason will be a little bit scarier. But you do have to sort of ask the question now. The good thing is that they haven't traded Russell Wilson. The bad thing is everything else.
Well, the bad thing is they haven't done anything as yet to address his concerns. And obviously there's still time for them to do that.
And there's still linemen out there.
Including Rodney Hudson, who the Raiders waived despite it taking a massive cap hit. It was a very perplexing move. But if that's one of the guys Russell Wilson hypothetically wanted to play for the Raiders, then bringing him here would be a great move. Especially because he doesn't count against the compensatory picks formula.
Oh, and they hate those compensatory picks. They would go way out of their way to avoid having to sign somebody during the compensatory picks timeline.
It's always 50-50 whether the Seahawks are going to be all in on comp picks or completely ignore them and throw caution to the wind and sign a bunch of qualifying free agents for like $2 million, slightly more than the minimum.
So there were some big-name linemen that signed elsewhere during the first day of free agency. If you were expecting the Seahawks to be active on the first day of free agency, you have not been paying attention to the Seahawks. The reality is, I don't think there's been a time in Pete and John's tenure that they've signed a big name free agent immediately, right?
I don't think so. I mean, they made the Jimmy Graham trade and the Percy Harvin trade around those times.
These are
right?
not the same things, though. This is a how they view free agency thing. And they do not want to be part of that initial rush. And they haven't. And again, just because Russell Wilson was disgruntled doesn't mean that they're going to fundamentally change how they approach free agency.
It does not appear so. So Corey Linsley signed with the Chargers. That was one of those... Kevin Zeitler was someone who got mentioned a lot because of the fact that he played with Russell Wilson in college and also was waived, so therefore did not count against the comp pick formula. But Baltimore signed him before the start of the legal tampering period, or at least agreed to a deal with him. And then the other player you would look at in this possibility as far as the big name offensive lineman would be Joe Tooney, who signed with the Chiefs. So, I mean, there are definitely still some names out there. And I think Hudson foremost in terms of making sense for what the Seahawks need.
And I think I would, and especially with him, you know, he's not a guard, but he is somebody who is in that interior place where a lot of the pass rush comes from in the NFC West, you know, namely Aaron Donald, right? If there is somebody who's going to be right in front of Russell Wilson, helping Russell Wilson feel protected, that is going to be a huge deal.
Trey Turner is also someone I think who could make sense, very effective in Carolina for several years before being traded for former Seahawk Russell Okung in a bit of a challenge trade last offseason, and then having a disappointing season with the Chargers, but still 28 hypothetically in his prime. So he's another player I think that would make sense if the market is right. But we've seen once again the Seahawks philosophy is like they have a price on players, and if the bidding goes beyond that price, they're not going to pay it, even as much as they may value those players, which ultimately cost them Shaquille Griffin is the biggest departure so far in free agency of the three Seahawks free agents who have all signed thus far or agreed to sign with Jacksonville, the others being Carlos Hyde and Philip Dorsett.
And Shaquem Griffin also, right?
I don't think that one's done, but it looks like it's happening.
Okay.
I mean, someone needs to Photoshop a Jaguars Seahawks combination logo when you consider that you've also got Daryl Bevel, Brian Schottenheimer, and Brian Schneider all on the Jacksonville coaching staff in addition to these players.
It's like you want to be in on the Jags, but then you've also got Urban Meyer.
Yeah, it's a real tough part of it. It's also very funny because, like, usually you see when an offensive coordinator goes to a new team, they'll bring in veterans from his old team to help the players learn the system. And you would say that's happening with Shoddy and Daryl Bevel, but all we're told is that it's actually Pete Carroll's system they were running in Seattle. So, you know, it's going to be something totally different under Urban Meyer in Jacksonville. Well,
and Philip Dorsett didn't play a game, and Carlos Hyde is a backup running back. Like,
I don't actually think that was a big part of it, but it's amusing.
How devastating do you think the Shaquille Griffin loss is?
I don't think it's devastating. It's disappointing. I think this was something Brady Henderson mentioned in his story about the Seahawks actually coming to a deal with Puna Ford, which we'll talk about in a second, is the limited number of draft picks who have gotten second contracts in Seattle in recent years. And Griffin adds to that. I mean, one of the reasons I think that you try to stay out of high-priced free agency is so that you can retain your own free agents. Somehow the Seahawks are in many ways doing neither of those things. They're just constantly trading for expensive players instead, I guess.
Yeah, no, they're doing everything wrong. Don't get me wrong here.
Not everything wrong.
Yeah, but they drafted Russell Wilson.
I mean, not signing tie-in free agents is a good strategy. It's just you should be using that to retain from within.
I still think the number was pretty high for Shaquille Griffin, and the Seahawks haven't necessarily proven that they can develop other cornerbacks, but you know they did something with Akella Witherspoon, which we'll be talking about in a second, and I wouldn't be surprised if there was at least one more free agent that they brought in the secondary.
No, I mean, that would make sense. You want to create competition there. I mean, people have talked about trying to re-sign Quentin Dunbar at a relatively low price coming off of his injury-plagued season, give him more time in the system. I mean, I would say that at that price, which was 3 years up to $44.5 million, $29 million of which is guaranteed, I neither like nor dislike the contract.
Really?
It's fine.
Don't you feel like you have to be signing a Pro Bowl cornerback at that point? Or a pretty top tier cornerback, right? Like,
I mean, it's going to be at the top of the cornerback market in free agency, but given Shaquille Griffin's age and his performance, I mean, he belongs in that group.
It's just, it's a tough number to get to for Shaquille Griffin. And he had some very good seasons in Seattle, but I think this was the right move. I think letting him go was the right move, given the cap situation that they're in, given that they need to spend money in other places. Look, the reality is, if letting Shaquille Griffin walk means that the Seahawks are able to spend money on the offense and the offensive line, that's the best allocation of resources. And spending, while you ideally would probably want to spend on a player in the secondary rather than, say, run-stuffing defensive linemen or former Seahawks that you're giving way too big of contracts to, which some of those have to be coming. Don't worry.
It's only a matter of time. Maybe by the time you listen to this podcast, it will have already happened.
You only get so many of these types of contracts to throw around when you have a quarterback like Russell Wilson who's making the money that he's making. You don't get that many of these opportunities to spend this money, and you have to be damn well sure that they're going to be somebody who's going to help you win games. And Shaquille Griffin may be that, but is the difference between Rodney Hudson and the next best option on the offensive line greater than the difference between Shaquille Griffin and the next best option in the secondary? Obviously, they haven't signed Rodney Hudson, but could there be...
Probably won't. Odds are against it. Let's be clear.
Could there be somebody else also? Could there be another lineman? You know, could this money be spent there? And I think that's an important thing to factor in.
Yeah, I mean, well, we'll have a better sense of this as free agency evolves. I do feel like there's some reasons to be encouraged by the Akello Weatherspoon contract.
Okay, let's hear it.
Which was, or the addition. I guess I don't love the one-year deal make good, although I think a lot of players are going to be wanting to sign contracts like that because of the fact that the cap is so low this year and they want to get back out into free agency next year. Witherspoon was drafted 24 picks ahead of Quill in the 2017 third round out of Colorado, where he was a part of the Buffalo's team that lost to UW in the 2016 Pac-12 championship game. Witherspoon became a starter midway through his rookie season and started 29 of the 36 games he played his first three seasons before starting just 4 of 11 games in 2020, including the final three. Despite that more limited playing time and losing his starting job, he had a really strong PFF grade last season of 80 as compared to 64 for Griffin. And surprisingly strong tracking stats over the 3 years we have data for that on Pro Football Reference via Sports Info Systems, allowing 6.4 yards per target over that span as compared to 7.9 for Griffin. Perhaps part of the reason, I mean, this, first off, here's my drinking game. If you listen to a number of Seahawks podcasts, drink every time someone refers to Akello Weatherspoon as Seahawksy, because he is so Seahawksy. He was in the 94th percentile among quarterbacks in projected Spark score via our friend, third Pelton brother, Zach Whitman, fourth among cornerbacks in the 2017 draft, right behind Shaquille Griffin, with Kevin King coming in number one of that group.
Ah, free Kevin King.
He's in the 99th percentile among quarterbacks in height, 94th percentile in vertical, was 40-yard time, and splits were solidly above the 80th percentile. And then if the Seahawks weren't already convinced, he actually played quite well against them in Week 17. The Seahawks completed just 2 of 6 passes with Witherspoon in coverage for 11 yards in that game.
This feels like a great signing to me. Am I missing something here? Is it just, I mean, he lost his starting job last year. Is that it?
He was very inconsistent. He was considered very inconsistent during his time in San Francisco. He also was taken out of the lineup in the 2019 playoffs during their run to the Super Bowl. But he's the kind of guy you'd want to bet on. I mean, we'll see what the money is. And like I say, it would have been preferable if you had the benefit, if he plays well, that you've got him under contract for 2022. But I understand why that might not make sense for him.
So it's all ex-Niners at cornerback now next year.
It does appear that way, yes, with TJ Reid on the other side.
Could there be a third ex-Niner in the mix we have not heard much about?
It's plausible. One thing I didn't realize when we were talking to Mike Sean about how the market for KJ Wright and Richard Sherman was going to be all former Seahawks defensive coordinators is that there's actually like a lot of those out there now, because Dan Quinn landed, Gus Bradley, so... These guys have options. That's what I'm telling.
If that number that you're looking at, I mean, we just don't know what the salary cap number for Akello Weatherspoon is. But if that number is a reasonable number, this feels like a pretty safe bet to make. And not to, again, the Seahawks have been fairly successful by not paying free agents. There are not that many scenarios where you paid sort of like a second tier free agent like Shaquille Griffin, and it ended up being a great signing. There's a handful of scenarios, but in general, you're probably overpaying players because that's kind of the nature of a free market, right?
Yes.
I don't know. I'm into this as an idea. The Seahawks don't have a lot of money, and if they're going to be spending their money, clearly they want to bring back. They wanted to bring back Puna Ford, and I think they are wanting to bring back KJ Wright. Feels like that market is not materialized necessarily that much. So hopefully that'll be a pretty solid number that they're bringing back KJ Wright on. And they need to spend money on offense at some point. They were going to wait out the first couple of days of free agency, but there's still a lot of players out there and there are a lot of valuable players that are left.
Well, we also haven't talked about Edge, where Carlos Dunlap remains a free agent. We haven't heard anything about his market really. And then also out there, Just waiting for a reunion. You know they love bringing players back, Jadeveon Clowney.
You know it's coming. You know it's about to happen. The Carlos Dunlap thing, the fact that we haven't heard a lot about it, these teams, after the first couple of days, there's not going to be that much money left. You know, this might be more so than ever the best time to have saved your money through the first handful of days, right? Especially because you do have teams like the Jags spending so much, the Patriots spending so much, and some of the bigger name teams that had enough room for a contract. And then they went out and made that signing. There could be an opportunity for a team that waited out for a second to maybe scoop up a couple of these guys.
Certainly hope that's the case. You mentioned the Puna Ford contract, reportedly 2 years, up to $14 million for Ford, who would have become a restricted free agent on Wednesday, assuming the Seahawks had tendered him a qualifying offer, or whatever the equivalent is in football. It's a qualifying offer in basketball. That's a large number. We'll see how it's actually structured and how much of that is in terms of incentives, because, you know, they probably would have tendered him at the second round level, which I think would have been a 1 year offer for $3.4 million. So he's certainly going to do better. He's going to do a bit better than that in 2021, and then maybe a lot of upside for him in 2022 to avoid potentially getting back into unrestricted free agency. You have no take on this.
I mean, I'm excited about Puna coming back.
I mean, Puna Hive, for sure.
And they also need him. I mean, they're looking at a lot of position groups of need right now, and keeping Puna Ford with the potential of, you know, potentially bringing back somebody like Carlos Dunlap, Jadeveon Clowney. The pass rush is looking okay. You know, with the Alton Robinson having a nice year, Daryl Taylor not playing a snap last year, but somebody who I think they're still counting on to be part of the pass rush eventually, LJ Collier developing. You know, there are enough players on that line. Bringing Puna back.
You forgot their best pass rusher?
Who, Jaren Reed?
Jamal Adams.
Oh, yes.
Well, the Seahawks have also been linked to one notable outside free agent.
Don't.
Reportedly. Deciding between them and a return to Tampa Bay, along with everyone else who's coming back for one more year, running it back as the defending champs. That's the most predictable potential Seahawks signing of all, Leonard Fournette.
God, kill me.
Definitely, like, you want to spend on a running back, and particularly you want to spend on a running back who's been really ineffective on the regular season, but had a great playoff run, because always carries over.
We really hope that the Bucs get their way and bring back. I would love to see the Buccaneers bring the gang back together.
Oh, you got to keep it together.
You got to keep the. It's just like that. That it feels very 7-9. The Buccaneers, what they're building right now. But
I'm sorry, what you think is 7-9? I mean, there's some regression to the mean, but
they weren't.
I like what they're doing.
Do you?
Yeah, I mean, they were a very good team. It wasn't like a fluky Super Bowl one. They were number one in DVOA, weren't they?
And if they were lucky on defense, and they have a 44-year-old quarterback.
He's going to play forever.
They're going to miss the playoffs next year. But they should pay Leonard Fournette. I think that would be a really good decision. The Buccaneers are definitely, they're going to have the first place schedule. They're not making the playoffs. I'm sorry.
Wow.
You could throw it
the NFC block. South is looking so tough.
A lock as an
Taysom Hill at quarterback for the Saints.
Jameis! That team's going to be 12-4 with Jameis quarterback. God.
I mean, I hope Jameis wins the starting job.
You know what? I've talked myself into the Seahawks offense or offseason, though. Let's go. This is the exact way to do it.
They send like $6 million, until they trade for Zach Ertz, actually, is what the next move will be.
I like the Keller Witherspoon signing. I like that there are still players out there and that they potentially have the opportunity to go out and get more.
What level of signing did the Seahawks need to make for us to do an emergency pod before next week?
I don't know if Ronnie Hudson warrants it.
Okay.
Do you think a center warrants?
It's tough. I don't know how much we could really discuss that.
Who knows? You know, everything is on the table for the Seahawks. They could trade for anybody. They could do literally anything. I mean, they could potentially trade Russell Wilson, but as of right now, it's still, the Seahawks are smart at playing free agency. Like they're not wrong here. They're not wrong. You're skeptical about that, but they're not wrong. You look at
the Seahawks. avoid the most obvious missteps in free agency. They make different mistakes in free agency than other teams.
I guess, yes, what I should say is by not being aggressive in the first day or two of free agency,
the Seahawks should not treat free agency the way their fans want them to treat free agency. I will agree with that.
And that is the right way to do it. Paying ex-Seahawks more money than they should be paid, I'm not so sure about that, but I think they had one very, very bad free agency offseason last year. And other than that, they've been mostly fine at it.
What was the year they signed? The year they signed the cornerback who got cut midseason. But there was also, who was the lineman that we were debating whether they were going to make it the full season? I can't even remember who it was anymore. They all run together these offseasons.
Was it Luke Jokel?
It probably was. Yeah, it was Luke Jokel. Yes.
Look, I'm not saying that the Seahawks have been great at this, but you want it to be low risk players in general. Free agency is bad. Free agency is a bad way to build a team, right?
Free agency, for lack of a better word, is bad.
I mean, do you disagree with this? Like, I look at this Patriots offseason, everybody's lauding it. It's like, what have you accomplished here? Are you a 9-7 team now? You know, like, there's still so many glaring issues on that roster. And also, the thing that we're not talking about is the NFC West has not added basically anybody. You know, you look pretty much across the board.
Well, they did add J.J. Watt, just like ahead of free agency. Also, the Matthew Stafford trade, like which can finally become official tomorrow.
Oh, there we go. That's really nice. You seem weirdly excited about it finally becoming official.
I feel for the Rams, you know, front office and social media staff. What was the team that had that tweet about it? It was the Chargers, right? About how we're not allowed to say anything, even though at NFL can say something. I felt that as someone who's worked for a team.
The Rams have lost Michael Brockers. Like, there have been losses from these teams in the NFC West and not a lot of additions. And I'm sorry, but like...
James Johnson, also from the Rams secondary.
The Rams in general...
That's not his name. What's his name?
That seemed right. Johnson?
It's definitely Johnson.
It has not been an offseason where you would look at the NFC West and say, these teams have massively retooled. Like the J.J. Watt signing, sure, great. But, that's a lot of faith in Matthew Stafford. I'm sorry, I'm not there with you.
John Johnson, legendary Sonic champion.
So, but there were depth losses for these other clubs in the NFC West.
Yes, not just the Seahawks feeling the talent drain at the moment. Well, we'll come back to sports, but now it's time to talk about food and resume our search for Seattle's best fried chicken, as advertised last week at Mangosteen Boba Bar. To reiterate, we talked about this back in the fall when I first went there, but Chef Tai Ha had operated previously at festivals and farmers markets, which is tough for a pandemic. Noticed the former Faux Bach boat boarded up and asked if he could operate out of there. Added chicken sandwich and brisket to his staple chicken wings, the location named after the fruit indigenous to Southeast Asia. So this was your first Mangosteen experience after I've had a couple of chicken sandwiches there before realizing that they also offered chicken strips. And it didn't seem like you were a huge fan.
Still pronounced Fubach. you're so close every time.
A's are very hard for me.
I think you pronounced the pho part wrong this time.
Oh, I think I did, didn't I? Oh, no. Pho back.
You were
pho back.
You were so focused on getting the bok part right. You screwed up the pho.
I know that part. That part I know.
Just say it natural. Let it roll off your tongue. Pho back. Pho back. Pho back. Anyway. I think this could be another casualty of the way that I was consuming it, which was off the floor of your car.
That is correct. Unfortunately, the boxes were a little loose, and the driving was not great, and there were some sudden stops at times.
The boxes were a little loose and the driving was not great.
The driving was loose too. The one in front of me didn't yield. They stopped at a yield and it really threw me off. Right near your house.
Chicken was everywhere.
At the roundabout.
Chicken went flying.
Chicken and wedge potatoes.
Waffle fries.
Not wedge potatoes, waffle fries.
Waffle fries are splattered against your windshield.
Jan picked out a waffle fry later, a day later.
Oh, God. Wow. Okay. Oh, my God. Jan's just like getting in your car being like, what is this? A waffle fry? Okay.
She wasn't upset about it. She heard the floor chicken story.
If it were me, I would have eaten it.
She just was very concerned with cleaning it up immediately.
Oh, God. I think that the quality could have been a casualty of how I was eating this. I was the one who sucked it up and ate the chicken off the floor. I don't know if I specifically tasted that, but it's just like, you know, the chicken had been places, right? It had flown all around your car. It had been microwaved after that.
It had seen shit.
So, it just didn't hold up. I mean, that's the thing is, in this process, eating it fresh, I ate the cookies chicken that I felt like was the best chicken in Seattle so far. Extraordinarily fresh, and it was
probably
still hot.
Not a coincidence.
It was still hot and it was still juicy. And this chicken was reheated and ended up just, it kind of tasted stringy through that process.
See, I don't understand. This is not something I get from it. So what I would say, number one, previously when I've been there, I've had the chicken sandwich. And I think it's better as a chicken sandwich than it is chicken strips. Because the flavor of the strips is not necessarily overwhelming if you get it as, it's not sauce on the side, basically.
And this was the mangosteen, by the way. This is a chicken strip with like a fish sauce and breading.
No, you did not have the mangosteen.
Oh, which one did I have?
You had either lemon
I
pepper.
Had the floor of your car.
Yes, you did. Mm-hmm. That was the... either the lemon pepper or the...
It did not taste like lemon pepper.
The other one was garlic honey, I believe, was the other one.
Maybe it was the garlic. And it might have just been the one that I had also.
Because the mangosteen, to me, was the most flavorful of those three by a considerable amount. And you said you hated fish sauce.
I
think that's what you said.
I don't.
That's what I recall you saying.
It's too far. I said I didn't only want fish sauce. I wanted to try some other things.
I said you didn't end up eating any of the fish sauce.
Quote, I'm not as big on fish sauce as you.
I heard I hate fish sauce. The brioche bun is a really strong piece of the chicken sandwich in addition to the chicken.
Well, let me just be honest here. We're not judging Seattle's best brioche
we're
bun.
We're not. I just want to point that out as we're discussing, having this conversation. So my takeaway was that it was obviously similar to having also done fish sauce strips at Bacabac, but I thought it was slightly preferable to that.
Really? You thought this was preferable to Bacabac?
I did. You're a little higher on Bacabac than I am. Or at least their chicken strips.
I'm sorry, you're just wrong about that. Like, Bacabac is a, and again, I guess I don't know if I've had Bacabac after probably 40 minutes and flying around your car. I don't know if I've had that exact same scenario, but like Bacabac holds up every single time. It's crunchier, right? Like the Bacabac breading, the way that they do the breading on the chicken strip, I think it's double fried at Bacabac, right?
It is, yes. It's Korean style.
And it's like a crunch, and then there's the juicy inside. I'm sorry, but this does not compare to that.
The other thing I think that makes it better as a sandwich than as a chicken strip is that the breading comes off a little more when you're holding it and eating it than when it's in the sandwich. So all told, again, I think better as a sandwich.
I don't blame mangosteen for this. I think it was a casualty of the way that we were eating it and the pandemic, but it was... Given that scenario, I think it was maybe the worst of the chicken that I've had so far.
Wow. Wow.
Well, no, I mean, the stall chicken was the worst chicken.
Okay.
Really gets it hard. It was just kind of bad, right?
It wasn't great.
Okay, so it was better than that. What did I give that?
I don't know what you gave. I don't know off the top of my head what you gave that off.
Remember when you gave the Costco burger a 50?
It was really bad. It was one of the worst meals I've had.
That's maybe the worst grade that has ever been given on a podcast search.
It was like when I gave an F in the All-Star grids.
To win Butler of Arcade Fire. He's trying.
I was not to win Butler, good sir.
Oh, to Lil Baby? Come on. Look, you know, the competition is really high out there. You shouldn't have given him an F. Quavo's really good at basketball.
Win Butler was the MVP, good sir. until he got in trouble for his speech. You gave... wait, what were you asking? What you gave the Ethan Stoll chicken?
Yeah, yeah.
73.
Okay, this was like an 80. 78.
78.
Did you grade the celebrity game? You can't compare 2 Chainz and Quavo to Lil Baby. They're like borderline semi-pro basketball players.
I have not. Someone else graded the celebrity game back when the celebrity game existed.
Oh, really?
Hmm. Yeah, because it occurs in a different location.
Schmitz, did they let Mike Schmitz do it? No.
I believe it might have been Sam Alipour, but I'm not sure about that. That's my vague recollection.
This year, though, even though it was all virtual, you didn't get to grade the 2-on-2.
There was no celebrity game.
Who was sponsoring the DaBaby, Lil Baby, Quavo?
That was independent. I don't know who was sponsoring that, but it was not NBA affiliated.
Okay, so you do not grade not NBA affiliated games. No.
Come on. Who do you think I am? Anyways, I gave Mangosteen an 89.
An 89?
It's our biggest discrepancy by far.
It's fine. I'm fine with that. I'm sure Mangosteen. The thing is, you have very positive memories of Mangosteen, and I don't, because the only way that I've had it, I would like to try it again. Should it advance forward in a scenario where maybe I'm picking it up or I'm eating it fresh, because I'm sure it is significantly better fresh.
I think it's somewhat better fresh. Yeah. Wanted to talk quickly about 2 other locations in our Seattle food update.
All right.
First off, Harried and Hungry, which is a sandwich shop in Georgetown. And one of the things I have been looking for is a good sandwich place near me. Mm-hmm. I used to frequent Hitchcock Deli back when they were operating in Georgetown, but that closed a few years ago, right when I ordered it for our search for Seattle's best sandwich. I'm not sure if I ever got charged for that, but I think I might have. Like, they still had the ordering online up, but the place was long closed. And I somehow I didn't know about Harried and Hungry until recently, and I've gone there twice now. And this most recent time, you had convinced me to watch the movie Chef, starring Jon Favreau.
That order that you made at Hitchcock Deli still somehow scored better than the Costco burger.
Oh, it did. It 100% did, because I was thinking of the other times I had gone there and had what was Seattle's best cookie. As well as the OG roast beef. Quite a good
the meal that you paid for and never got. 51?
Paying nothing. Still better because I didn't have to eat anything. This was the Costco burger. We both paid and had to eat the Costco burger. It was a waste of a perfectly good meal. But so the movie Chef with Jon Favreau.
Yes.
Where he opens up. Not spoiler alert, he opens up a food truck to serve Cuban sandwiches, and this made me want nothing in life more than a Cuban sandwich. Mm-hmm. So I ordered a Cuban from Harried and Hungry, and it was phenomenal.
Oh God, I want that so bad.
Good.
What I've didn't had... I didn't go to your house and pick it up. Was this on a weekday? What was
it was
I
on
doing?
A weekday, yes.
Okay,
that's why you didn't.
Okay,
I've had.
I was gonna say, I feel like it would require something pretty extreme for me not to get a Cubano.
You were pretty excited about it as well after watching the movie.
Tell me more. It was excellent. Is it the best Cubano you've ever had?
I think it probably was, yes.
Wow.
So, I forget what the first sandwich I had there was. Let me double check if it...
You've been there twice.
I have been there twice. The first time I did not tell you guys, and you were very upset that I did not. This time I did offer it, and no one took me up on it. I'm not sure. It must have been one of the specials, because I'm not recognizing it on the menu right now. but very quality sandwiches.
Where is it at in Georgetown?
Where is it at in
this
Georgetown?
This is the part of the podcast where I'm just gathering information. You're gonna give descriptive words that are only going to be familiar to me. This is not for general consumption. I'm literally just trying to find out where it is in Georgetown.
We got to make a right at the Soto Chicken.
Is it in? It's in that part of Georgetown, though.
It's on Michigan Street.
Okay, so it's not in the new epicenter area.
No, it's not over there.
Okay.
So, did that sufficiently answer your question?
Well, how does it? Where is it in relation to the Arby's?
It's not quite as close to the entrance to I-5 as the Arby's.
Okay. Oh, Lord.
Right near the Counterbalance Brewing Company, which I need to hit up at some point to get beer.
I think I went there over the summer, right? Didn't I talk to you about that? Sort of in like an industrial park. I went in there. I got some sour beers.
No, it's not in an industrial park. Well, I mean, it is. It's an industrial area, but I wouldn't
fucking
call it a park.
Georgetown. Let me just. I'm pretty sure I went to the Counterbalance Brewing. Yeah, looking at this photo, yes.
Okay.
I went there over the summer and got some beers. I feel like I gave you some, but maybe I didn't. I got kind of a lot.
It's technically in the same building as Counterbalance, but on the opposite side.
I like that area. Man, I went in there into Counterbalance, and it was just like, I fucking hate this virus. It was like, it was sunny outside. I had my entire family, and you can usually bring kids into these places, right? They were all just sitting in the fucking van. And I'm like, wait here. Dad needs to go get beer. And if this would have been a normal scenario, I could have just loaded all these goddamn children onto a, you know, bench seat that they have in most breweries. And me and Mrs. Fantasy Genius could have drank two or three beers or whatever while they just sat on phones and iPads and shit. And it would have been excellent. It would have been an epic night. And then we might have even invited you.
I want to know for the record, I also hate this virus.
Yeah.
It's got a low approval rating.
For me, it's mostly about not being able to go to the Counterbalance Brewing. Anyway, Jay, let's vaccinate these restaurant workers and brewery workers.
bit.ly/vaxrestwork.
Counter.balance.
Do you want to talk about the location you went to for the first time last week, Salty Blue?
So this is a new, I'm thinking, look, you're pressuring me on time here. We've got so much more to get to. This is a new Australian style fish and chips restaurant in downtown Renton. And I would say it's kind of popping off in downtown Renton. And, you know, it's to go only, but there was a long line of people ahead of me when I went there. I was the last person on Friday night, and I'm going to use this as a moment to say, if you put good food in downtown Renton, people will come to get it at every single restaurant, which is not in downtown Renton. Poliachi Pizza, Cafe Vita, Lil Woody's. Anyway, the people are desperate for good food in downtown Renton. And Salty Blue was very good. You know, we got the sampler platter for two, which was two pieces of fish and chip style fish, which it's Australian style. I don't know what the difference between Australian and British style is, because they seem very similar to me, which it's one long piece of fish, right? It's not the little tiny tenders that you're used to at Ivor's or something like that. Then there was a potato cake. There was also with the chips, potato cake, really not necessary. Then there was a piece of fried shrimp and a fried calamari. Both of those were kind of take it or leave it on those two. But just the straight fish and chips, the piece of fish was phenomenal. The fries were excellent. And look, if you're a fish and chips place and your fish and chips is good, that's all you need.
You've nailed it.
Yeah, there's not.
Well, they also have chicken. I wanted to include them in our search for Seattle's best chicken. You're skeptical.
We don't need to include a fish and chips place in our search for Seattle's best chicken. That's my conclusion. And their fish and chips is great. They don't need to do more than fish and chips. I don't need to consume more than fish and chips there. That's what I'm going to be getting from now on. So it's excellent. And I fucking love the British style, Australian style fish and chips, where it's the one long piece and you can break it apart. It feels like you're eating an actual fish. Because what part of the fish is what you're getting at Iver's? You know what I mean? It's just like, that is no part of a fish that is cut into those small slices.
Which part of the chicken are you getting? Were you getting chicken chips? We could go too far with this question.
I think we maybe should go that far with the question.
No.
Because the reality is here, I think through this search, I've kind of become anti-chicken strip.
Wow! He went from hating the bones to loving the bones.
Yeah.
Classic Tristan Tech.
Cookies did it to me. I'm telling you, they ruin strips forever. Give me the bones. Look, if you can do the bones right, look, you're eating a chicken. Why do you need to eat this bastardized version of an animal where you're chopping off these little pieces and frying it? Give me the real thing. Give me a goddamn drumstick. You know what I mean? A drumstick and a wing and a thigh and a breast and the other parts of a chicken, which you could possibly eat. Why are you upset about this? I'm sorry.
It's the flip-flop nature of it.
It's not a flip-flop nature. I'm sorry. It's about learning more about something and updating your perspective about it.
Your position has evolved.
What is that? Is that not true? Think about how much more chicken I'm eating right now and how much more critically I'm thinking about the chicken that I'm eating now versus January or whatever. Look, I feel like, if anything, I should be lauded for this perspective.
You always feel like, if anything, you should be lauded.
If I was this Fremont beer, I would say. And also, I mean, you know, like, chicken, no bones. Oh, Lord. Anyway, you don't agree with this, though. I've started to feel over time like I was eating the mangosteen strips, and I was like, I need a bone in here.
No, I'm still not a bone-in guy.
All right, well, fair enough.
I'm not pandering to the fan, to the listener, like you are.
I'm just different, I guess.
Should we talk about sports again? We already have. Let's get back to sports, starting with the Sounders. As I teased earlier, MLS opening weekend schedule has been announced, and the Sounders will help kick off the season on Friday, April 16th by hosting Minnesota United in a rematch of last year's exciting Western Conference Championship on FS1.
There we go. Basically a month to the day.
Oh, yes, from now. The other Sounders news... Jovan Jones signed with Inter Miami as a free agent. Jones helped the Sounders to two MLS Cup victories during his two stints in Seattle, starting both matches as well as both MLS Cup final losses for the Sounders in 2017 and last year in 2020. So good luck to Jovan Jones as he repeats Roman Torres's journey from the Sounders to Inter Miami.
I look forward to his third stint on the Sounders.
Could come soon if Roman Torres is an example.
The Sounders are like, they're like the Seahawks junior.
Lamar Nagel had like three stints here.
People will always make their way back.
Let's turn our attention to UW sports to wrap things up. We got a lot of UW news to get to, starting with softball. In a return to Husky Softball Stadium for the first time since May 2019, the Huskies swept two matchups, each with Portland State and Seattle U by a combined 22-3 score.
There we go.
Last weekend, Gabby playing through a shutout Friday versus Portland State and
struck
out 14 in a complete game Saturday against the Redhawks, despite allowing a run for the third outing she's done so this season. Hmm. I know. Real tough if you're going to allow a run. I don't know even what you're doing.
You know what I call that?
Room
for improvement.
Oh, yes. Yes, absolutely. All right, the Huskies moved up a spot to number 7, and they jumped over the team they face this weekend. They host this weekend. Number 8, Arizona. As they start Pac-12 play for the first time since 2019, the Wildcats were ranked number 2 last week after starting 12-0 before losing Monday at UCF and then dropping 2 of 3 games at number 15, Florida State. They're led by catcher Deja Mulapola, who has 8 home runs in 17 games so far this season. Their A's pitcher, Alyssa Dunham, is 6-3 with a 1.28 ERA.
6-3 with a 1.28 ERA. Come on!
I mean, for softball, that is not good for an A's pitcher. It's wild.
Are these games on TV? Can we watch these?
Some of them. I believe Friday night's game is on ESPNU.
Hello.
Nationally televised softball.
There we go. I mean, this is a major Pac-12 matchup here. Look, I understand basically every team in the Pac-12 is in the top 10 in women's softball, but I'm down to watch these softball matches. Are there going to be fans? If we could be at up to, whatever, 20,000 fans, 25% capacity, are there going to be fans at these softball games?
I don't know if UW is yet doing fans. I think they're still doing player coach guests. Not sure on that, though.
Okay.
So Friday at 6 p.m. on ESPNU. Saturday, a doubleheader, 3:30 and 6, both on Pac-12 networks. And Sunday, also on Pac-12 networks at noon.
What does that mean, Pac-12? So it's on Pac-12 Washington or whatever?
I assume so, yes.
Okay. So all games are televised. And if you're telling me there are fans in the stadium for this, the only time that I am willing to toast for fans in the stadium, it's for UW softball because they've earned it. That's right. UW softball has earned it. The Mariners, I will tell you this confidently, have not.
that is fair.
When was the last time the Sounders won an MLS Cup? It's been 2 years.
I mean, they have won MLS Cup more recently than the Huskies have gotten to the championship series.
That was when Jovan Jones was
college
on the team.
Series. UW women's basketball news. Head coach Jody Wynn was fired Monday after 4 years at the helm. So much for 2021-22 being a make or break season for Wynn. I mean, it's not surprising given the lack of success as the Huskies went 11-58 in conference games during her tenure. But surprising given the strong recruiting class incoming we mentioned last week and the 2 years remaining on her contract, although a pretty notable difference in terms of what the buyout is on for Jody Wynn is compared to Mike Hopkins on the men's side, who had signed an extension more recently. He has $12 million left on his contract. Jody Wynn had $700,000 left on her contract. So little easier to manage during a pandemic.
I guess so, but you're also highlighting how ridiculous it is the amount of money that NCAA men's basketball coaches are getting paid. Like,
yep.
This is not because of the product that they've put on the court. Mike Hopkins was able to leverage that into ridiculous long extension, as is the style for NCAA men's basketball coaches. But like, it's more about the discrepancy between these two sports and the financials that exist within them.
For sure. I mean, that's what enabled the Huskies to make this decision. I mean, it's interesting because, as we joked about on Twitter from the PeltonCast account, it is a very UW thing to fire a coach when they've got a great recruiting class coming in.
Buyout for Mike Hopkins is like $2 million per win he had this year. Thank you.
Well, it's more than that, isn't it? Yeah, it's over. $2.4 million.
Over. But why, though? It's like, are we unaware? I don't know. I'm surprised that I'm... This just doesn't feel like the right time, right? You had to go through this pandemic off season, you know, an awkward season for anybody to be a part of. You get another year, like that. That's the reality.
I don't think that's a good way to think about it, though. I mean, if you're convinced that Jody Wynn cannot be a successful coach at UW, and like I said, there's not a lot of evidence that on the court that she was going to be successful.
What about this recruiting class, though, that you talked about? There was was there not progress this year?
There wasn't progress this year. There was hope based on the recruiting class and based on Tamia Sadler. But I guess what I'd say here is, in a world where college athletes can transfer much more easily, which is a good thing, I don't know if like keeping the coach one extra year to save the recruiting class makes much sense. Like, they can just leave next year. And getting the right coach in place is more important than one recruiting class. And that's where the difference between
the perspectives about these coaches are usually based upon one season of success, and one season of success, then the coach is a great coach, and one down season, then they're a terrible coach. I mean, you could see it with Mike Hopkins, right? Like, the perspective that even we've had about Mike Hopkins is Mike Hopkins was Pac-12 coach of the year, and then he won five fucking games. You know what I mean? Like, these things can evolve very quickly. The idea that there's the right or the wrong coach, I'm not sure if that exists. I mean, we talk about remembering some years, right? Like Lorenzo Romar struck, things all came together during one season for Lorenzo Romar. But what if that hadn't happened? What if that season hadn't happened and the next year it would have?
I mean, they still had like three NBA players on the team. So I feel like the next year they probably would have figured it out. And they weren't going to fight. It was his second year at the helm. Like, it wasn't 4 years. She's had an entire recruiting cycle. And there's been, the best season was they won 5 conference games.
I don't know.
That's very bad.
I'm just so personally bothered by the entire infrastructure of college sports that it's really hard to even judge any decision that happens within it.
I mean, the other thing, I mean, you do have to go back to the original decision to hire Jody Wynn. Like, she wasn't on our list of candidates in 2017 when she was hired.
This is the the Pelton Cast list of candidates.
It's the official, which, by the way, I've got a list again.
Hello!
And it's all people who are back from 2017. I've added one person. I've added one person.
God.
There were so many other people they could have hired that they didn't hire.
Okay, so you feel like Jody Wynn was the wrong hire in 2017 and never...
I do.
Never proved themselves during that time period.
That tends to be my take.
Okay, all right. Walk us through your... You just Control-C, Control-V this from your notes from 2017.
I removed some people because there was one coach who had interviewed at USC and was there for when they had a vacancy at the same time and were ahead of the Huskies in the coaching search. So therefore I went with, and that coach, despite being very successful at that point, then immediately stopped being successful. So they are no longer on the list. And there's a couple others that aren't on the list.
Most coaches aren't going to be successful. That's the reality of this job, is basically any coach who comes in, the likelihood of them being fired eventually is extraordinarily high.
Eventually, yes. But I mean, UW's had two pretty big misfires on the women's basketball coaching front since they fired June Doherty. Like,
what if the issue is not the coaches themselves, but it's the institution?
I mean, the Pac-12 has become a very difficult place to win. And I think that's a factor in why Jody Wynn had such a hard time. But UW has the infrastructure and resources that they should not be one of the very worst teams in any sport. Like, it's realistic for them to expect to be in the top third of the Pac-12, I think, in any given sport. And maybe not in women's basketball just because it's so successful right now, but I think in the middle of the conference is a reasonable expectation.
What's happening in basketball then? Look, this isn't rowing. Like, you know? We can't compare those two things. But
you shouldn't be consistently worse than Washington State and Oregon State. Like, that's all I ask. Those schools are very difficult to recruit to. And guess what? Washington State women's basketball made the tournament, as we talked about a couple weeks ago. Only the second time in program history they made it. Oregon State won the fucking Pac-12 men's basketball tournament.
I learned about this because of, I think, a tweet from Bob Condotta or something. And I was like, oh, damn. Oh, cool.
I watched that game. Oh, nice. Exciting game.
Okay, fair enough. I guess the way that I would approach most situations is that I think talent and ability is less important than situation. Most often, situation is the most important thing that is going to happen for a coach, for an athlete, for a human being
UW situation was tough in that there was basically an empty cupboard left after Kelsey Plum went to the WNBA. Chantel Orsahor exhausted her eligibility, graduated. She's now, apparently both of them are now working with Mike Neighbors at Arkansas.
Oh, nice.
And Ari McDonald decided to transfer to Arizona, where she became the Pac-12 Player of the Year eventually. Like, she had a very successful run. All of us were emphasizing that, man, it would be great if Adia Barnes were the Huskies head coach instead. But, you know, she's coaching at her alma mater. She's certainly happy to be there.
Okay.
But, all right, my list at this point, which is slightly smaller than it was last time. Mark Campbell, who's the associate head coach at Oregon, has been with Kelly Graves since day one at Oregon, helping build the Ducks into a national power, was key to their recruiting of Sabrina Ionescu. First gained his reputation as ace recruiter at rival Oregon State, where he helped Scott Ruick rebuild that program. He seems overdue at this point to get a head coaching opportunity.
Okay.
My first call, though, would be to Lisa Fortier at Gonzaga. The former assistant to Kelly Graves was promoted when he left to take the Oregon job and has continued the Zags' success, reaching the last four NCAA tournaments and missing out just once in her seven seasons. That includes a trip to the Sweet 16 in 2015 as a number 11 seed and a first-round win in 2019. The Zags snagged a five seed in this year's tournament, tying 2019 for the highest in program history. This next one is, I think, a long shot, but Kate Pay is the Stanford associate head coach. She played for both the Rain and the Storm, and again, overqualified for a head coaching job. But I assume the reason she hasn't taken one is because she's probably not leaving Stanford, where her roots to the Cardinal run deep. Her parents went to Stanford, where her dad played football. She was born at Stanford Hospital, played for the Cardinal in the 1990s, and has spent 13 years as an assistant to legendary Tara Vanderveer. I would expect her to be Vanderveer's replacement. But then again, we all assumed Mike Hopkins wasn't leaving Syracuse either. So you got to make the call.
So hopefully she stays at Stanford.
I don't think you can necessarily read that much into it. All right, next up, UW women's basketball
born
legend Lori
Stanford Hospital. Wow,
I know.
Good God,
it's too perfect.
I got Stanford flashbacks of being at their stadium by you describing that.
Look, it was a great time. It was sunny.
You should have given me a trigger warning first before mentioning Stanford that many times.
Women's basketball, Lori Payne, who is the head coach at Northern Arizona. After her career at UW, she worked for the Huskies briefly as an assistant coach before beginning her head coaching career at UPS. She was hired by Northern Arizona from UPS in 2017 and lifted the team to its first above 500 finish in Big Sky play since 2007 in 2019-20 before they finished 500 this season. Gordy Presnell from Boise State, maybe a bit more of a long shot at this point. The former longtime SPU head coach had a streak of four consecutive Mountain West tournament championships snapped this year. Maybe a little late for him to make the jump to a power conference at age 60. And the last person, the lone newcomer to my list, is Noel Quinn, the Storm assistant coach, who is, I think, going to be a very good head coach at some point in the near future at whatever level it ends up being, whether it's college or the WNBA. She's also, in addition to her important role as an assistant for the Storm, serves as a head coach at the high school level. So she's getting that experience of actually running a team herself.
Which high school is that?
It is somewhere in the LA area.
Okay, so this is not in Seattle. Okay.
No, not here.
It's like, wow, you really were not able to come up with that.
In her native LA.
You're really kind of playing the hits here with where these coaches are coming from, at the very least.
Well, I mean, that's where you usually hire people who are up-and-coming coaches at mid-majors or assistants in Power 5 conferences. They didn't necessarily do either of those with Jody Wynn, but, you know.
Where did Jody Wynn come from? What was the...
Long Beach State.
Interesting. Is that not what you're talking about?
I just don't know that she had been as successful at Long Beach State as these coaches in mid-majors had been.
Okay. Well, I guess we'll see what this looks like, right?
They came 1 point shy of becoming the first number 15 seed to beat a number 2 seed in 17. So I guess that probably happened. I don't know if that happened after we did the pod.
We will see what the recruiting class looks like based upon who the new head coach is. I mean, I suppose I can understand that you would having the right coach in place. This is not a Lorenzo Romar scenario, right?
Jody Wynn isn't the most successful coach in UW women's basketball history.
Exactly. If there was somebody who you were going to give another year to, it would be the coach who led you to the greatest heights that the program has basically ever been to in the last half century. That Jody Wynn is not that coach. So from your description, Jody Wynn has not been wrongfully terminated or whatever from that position. I mean, I feel uncomfortable with the idea of anybody being fired from any job and hearing about it, you know. At the same time, Jody Wynn was compensated very well to coach players who weren't getting paid anything. So there's sort of a flip side to that coin, but I still wouldn't cheer it on.
Wasn't something I was encouraging, but it's not something I'm like criticizing either. It's like the Shaquille Griffin contract. It's fine.
Okay. You're judging that from the fan of the Jaguars perspective?
Lifelong Jaguars fan.
All right, welcome back to hour number two of the Duval podcast. Look, the Shaquille Griffin contract, it's fine.
First off, we would call it the Fabulous Duval cast, obviously.
Anyway.
Oh, boy. Shaquille Griffin contract, neither good nor bad.
Oh, my God. Anyway. Okay, so on episode... Stopping.
Should we talk about UW men's basketball?
One of the top 10 swamp cities in northeastern Florida.
All they need is new offense, a new defense, and some rule changes.
Hey, they might have gotten all of those things this year. If the Ravens get their way, they will have those rule changes. We got Shoddy. We got Urban Meyer. We've got Daryl Bevel. Trevor Lawrence is coming. Carlos Hyde at running back. Who needs Leonard Fournette when you've got Carlos Hyde?
So since we last podcasted, UW men's basketball has completed their season with a 98-95 loss in the Pac-12 tournament opening round last Wednesday versus Utah. The Huskies trailed the Utes by 19 with 5 minutes to play before a furious late rally saw them outscore Utah 27-11 the rest of the game to produce the highest scoring game in Pac-12 tournament history.
There we go. We'll always have that.
We will, but the Huskies never got the ball down any fewer than 6 points and only got within one possession thanks to Cole Bajuma's three-pointer with 1 second remaining. Mm. The Huskies finished, I guess I got to update this after the rest of the conference tournaments here. They finished number 173 in KenPom, which would be the... slightly behind the last Lorenzo Romar team, which was 163, ahead of the 2001 Bob Bender team at 181, is the second lowest rated in the KenPom era dating back to 1997. And they did avoid the worst simple rating system rating on the record, according to sportsreference.com's metrics. Still just the fifth time in 72 rated seasons that the Huskies have been worse than the Division I average, along with 2001 in three distant seasons, 1953-54, 1963-64, and 1965-66. So as we look ahead with UW men's basketball to 2021-22, unclear as yet if Quade Green or Hamir Wright might return for a fifth season of eligibility that they could get thanks to the pandemic. Either way, the Huskies seem to have a more competent perimeter unit in place with Jamal Bey, Eric Stevenson, and Marcus Sahonis, although Stevenson's shooting never quite came around as he finished at 42% from two-point range and 30% on threes. The biggest concern to me long-term is not that the Huskies ranked 175th in adjusted offensive efficiency on KenPom, though they could desperately use more playmaking after ranking 328th in assist rate.
Oh, God.
But that they were 177th in 100 adjusted defensive efficiency, which wasn't supposed to happen with their zone. They ended up playing a lot of man-to-man by the end of the season. After finishing 26th and 4th in opponent two-point percentage the previous two seasons, the Huskies dropped to 211th and went from two top five finishes in block rate to 152nd. The hope is that Jackson Grant can help. Worth remembering amidst the focus on the recruits that got away, notably Paolo Banchero and Shane Noel, that the Huskies did sign a McDonald's All-American in Grant, who should help their interior defense at 6'10".
Hope you have fun not playing in the tournament, Paolo.
Like he was going to play in the tournament here.
I'm just saying, if you're going to Duke, if you're willing to travel to Duke, the reason you go to Duke is for the success. Does that make sense?
I think Duke will be more successful next season. I'm willing to wager with you that they'll be in the NCAA tournament.
You've told me it's a totally different NCAA in the year 2021 than it was in 5-10 years ago. Kentucky is bad, right? Look, if Paolo Banchero wanted to play at a place that was good at basketball, he probably should have just gone to Gonzaga. Anyway.
Oh, I mean, he should have. Yes, definitely should have gone to Gonzaga. I think he'll be fine. I think the teams that are freshman laden will not be as bad next season because they probably will get more of a real offseason.
So what you're telling me is all the Huskies need is... an offense a defense. And maybe some rule changes. This was, they were bad at everything. The zone is a phenomenal zone, provided you have Matisse Thybulle, right? Like,
or, I mean, they were quite good with Isaiah Stewart and Jaden McDaniels defensively.
Okay,
they couldn't
provided you have two first round NBA draft picks. And you know, Jaden never really played. Who was playing at the...
Maybe two draft picks, because Jalen Noel was not a first-round pick the year before.
Who was playing at the middle of the zone on the Stewart McDaniels year?
Stewart, primarily.
Isaiah Stewart, who was playing up a little bit higher?
Oh, you mean on the top line at the zone?
Yeah. The T's position.
I mean, no one comparable to Matisse Thybulle. Sometimes they would have Jamal Bey there. Probably be the closest comp. I mean, that's a... not a typical thing in the Syracuse zone to have that kind of length at the top. That was an adjustment that Mike Hopkins made because Matisse Thybulle was so good. And now we've seen that it's become much more common in 2-3 zones at the NBA level.
What is Mike Hopkins, though? If he's not even playing the zone at the end of the year, literally, what are you getting here? The recruiting from upstate New York?
He's under contract for a long period of time.
Look, you should see these fucking Maple Leafs in the fall. Come on! Right? Like... I'm surprised. I don't get, at least the zone is an ethos, you know?
Say what you will about it.
Say what you will about recruiting in the state of Washington, but at least the zone is an ethos. To me, if I'm Mike Hopkins, I sacrifice winning or even being competitive for being like, fuck it, this is what we do, right? Because... like, what's the difference? If you lose by 3, if you lose by 20, there really isn't that big of a difference between these two things. And I hate to break it to you, they were losing all of these games no matter what, even if they managed to lose by 3 because of 3 at the end of the game.
A hopeless comeback?
Yes. So it's a little bit tough to just be like, wow, the coach abandoned their entire ethos on defense, and you're kind of left with nothing at that point. And we'll see what's going to happen.
I would say my hope is that the Huskies can be just ordinary bad next year.
It's a long off season and transfers are a very important thing. UW has been behind the curve with regards to transfers,
but not anymore on football. We'll talk about that in a second.
Possibly that could change. And if that changes, maybe they'll be competitive. And I do think that there is something building with these young players. You know, even saying all that about Mike Hopkins, I think that there is a bit of a young core that could lead to potentially a good Husky basketball team.
It's not even that young of a core, although everyone gets an extra year of eligibility now.
There's a good core of players who could be coming back, who maybe they were 5-21 this year, but 8-18 next year.
I mean, you're going to play more games next year, so by definition, they will, and especially more non-conference games. So by definition, they'll have a much better record next year. I'm very confident.
They didn't play that few. I mean, 26 is not that few games, right? Normally, they play about 30, 32.
But 20 of those were conference, 21 of those, if you count the tournament, were conference games, and 22 because they played Colorado in one of their non-conference games. They only played 4 non-conference games. Also, one of those was against Baylor, who was the number 2 team in the country most of the year. No, the fact that they lost to UC Riverside is still a problem. And to Montana. Oh, God, it was bad.
We'll always have that Cole Bajema 3 to make it a 3-point game.
I don't know if it covered the spread. Probably they had already covered it by that point. Let's revisit 2003-04.
Yes! Let us never speak of Husky basketball again.
Well, this season. Yes. Let's not speak of this season.
Look, we put a bow on the season. It's over. Mike Hopkins will be back. He's owed a hell of a lot of money that the players will never see. And maybe some of them will a little bit. But he's owed a hell of a lot of money. Mike Hopkins will be back next year. He will continue to recruit Syracuse and, oh, God, give me some cities.
Rochester.
Ithaca. Rochester. Look, you just put it...
What about Albany? Can he get Albany? Is that in his recruiting sphere?
Oh, my God. Look, he's been to Niagara, Albany. he can get the Southwest Ontario. I feel like he crosses over Niagara Falls. I'm just being honest.
What about Buffalo? We got Buffalo?
A bit of Buffalo. Look, it's about putting a fence around upstate New York. I think Albany is actually like many hours from most of these places.
So the Huskies,
it's been a long time since I've worked in booking, but I'm pretty sure that Albany is much farther west. But anyway.
So the Huskies entered the 2004 Pac-10 tournament needing a deep run to solidify an at-large berth and hoping to remove all doubt by winning the tournament after beating Stanford at home in the final weekend of the regular season. It was a back-and-forth opening round against number 7 seed UCLA, which was the only team to sweep UW during the Pac-10 regular season. Redman native Brian Morrison, a transfer from North Carolina, scored 23 points and gave the Bruins an 80-78 lead in the final 4 minutes before the Huskies went on a 7-0 run to take the lead for good. It was still a two-point game inside 30 seconds, but UCLA did not score again in the 91-83 UW win. Can I tell you a strange thing here?
Yes.
This is the only game from the 2004 Pac-10 tournament I remember.
Really?
Yeah.
I don't really have strong memories of... I think I was doing something. Like, I had a school thing to do, like, each of these nights for some reason.
On a Thursday, Friday, and Saturday?
I really think I did.
Okay.
In fact, I distinctly remember being... I was in community college at this point, right?
Yes, this was your freshman year at HCC.
Home of Brian Scalabrine. 253 is number one athlete. for episode 253. I think that I had to go to a live poetry reading for a class, which happened on the Friday night of the Pac-12 tournament. And it was at... bookstore that was right near a saloon in Pioneer Square, and I almost knocked over like 30 motorcycles. A very tough motorcycle man yelled at me after, and it was that exact
night. You're talking about Elliott Bay bookstore, right?
Yeah, it was at the Elliott Bay bookstore, and I was backing into a parking spot, and then when I was leaving, the person who worked it, it might have been like Cowgirls Inc. or whatever. I think that's what it was. It was the Cowgirls Inc. person who was outside was like, I saw you back in. How bad that was. I'm going to help guide you out. And I was like, and I was with a classmate of mine that I was interested in. And it was very emasculating.
There you go. This has been Tristan's life circa 2004.
Home of Brian Scalabrine.
So let's set up a Friday night matchup for the Huskies against Arizona.
This was the night I didn't watch this game because of this fucking poetry reading.
We're too busy at Cowgirls Inc. Early 15-2 run gave the Wildcats a 9-point lead, but the Huskies rallied to take a 2-point lead at halftime. Again, it was a 3-point game with 48 seconds left before Nate Robinson knocked down a jumper with 16.4 seconds left to seal the Huskies' third win of the year against Arizona. Robinson had 21 points while three reserves, Curtis Allen, Hakeem Rollins, who has not gotten a lot of love in the Let's Remember 2004, and Trey Simmons, who scored 19 points, all reached double figures. The Huskies became the first team since 1980 to beat Arizona 3 times in a season. With an important asterisk, the Pac-10 tournament had only been reinstated in 2002 after previously existing from 1987 through 90. Few teams actually played Arizona 3 times in a year.
No. Don't bring that up.
You're rejecting this nuance? So a week after the Huskies ended Stanford's undefeated season, the two teams met again on a Saturday for the Pac-10 title. The second UW appearance in a conference title game, having lost in 1987. This time, the Cardinal took control with a 12-0 run late in the first half.
There also wasn't a Pac-10 title game for many years in between there, right?
Again, yes. They had played in the first
we
one.
We only accept context when it's good for UW, but not when it's bad for UW.
They had arm's-length UW for a 77-66 win to leave the Huskies' fate in the hands of the selection committee. Although it turned out not to be much of a real sweat.
Where did we watch this game? Do you remember? Did we watch that together?
I don't remember at all. I remember the 2005 title game against Arizona so vividly, and going to play basketball with our cousin Chris beforehand and eating Domino's. But I have no memories of 2004.
And him as a massive 20-year-old or whatever tackling both of us.
Yeah.
In our grandparents' piano room.
Yep.
Tackling
us. I don't know if I would call it the piano room.
There was a piano and it was a room, so
I mean, yes, all of those things are true. Certainly it's, was a it's, room.
Kind of wild that we don't you don't remember where you were for this game. I don't either. I have no recollection.
The Huskies, the Sonics, Sonics were not playing at home, so I don't have that as an excuse.
Wow, I had no feud with Squatch, nothing.
Yeah. So the expectation was an 8 or 9 seed for the Huskies, and indeed they ended up 8th in the St. Louis Regional with a first round date in Columbus against number 9 UAB Alabama Birmingham. So we'll talk about how that went next week.
God, UAB.
On the exciting conclusion of Let's Remember 2003-04.
Let's discuss 2003-04. Let's revisit.
I mean, that'll be the conclusion to it. We're not going to keep going through the rest of the NCAA tournament that didn't include the Huskies. Who won that NCAA tournament?
Spoiler alert.
Yes, it is true. I have spoiled it. Who won the NCAA tournament that year? UConn.
I was going to say UConn.
Yeah, Mecca Okafor.
We played them as they were the defending champs. We played them the next year.
Wait, did we play them the next year?
Was that the year that we played them and lost?
No, I think it was 1998.
You don't remember UConn the next year?
We did not play them the next year.
Who did we play?
North Carolina State again?
What year Pittsburgh? Am I thinking of?
You're thinking of 98 when the Huskies played UConn in
the fucking Mike Jensen game.
Oh, that was in 06. That was 2 years later. They were the defending champs.
Oh, they were just the favorites. The next year, we had the number 1 seed, and we lost to fucking Louisville.
Correct.
And then 2 years later, we lost to UConn.
Yes.
God, there's nothing that will upset me more than that loss to UConn.
Even that loss to UConn?
I feel like... I don't know. We should revisit both of those. Next week when we revisit the loss to UAB or the game to UAB.
I definitely don't want to spoil that. Who would possibly know the outcome to a game that occurred 17 years ago? It's not, who could find that?
Can we just talk for a second about both of those next two losses? Because the screen that was set, Earl Clark, that was who set the screen, right?
It was not Earl Clark. We looked this. I looked this up at some point. I believe it was Take One. Was it Take?
Earl Clark was he was on the team though, right? But he didn't set that screen on Bobby.
I don't even think he was on the team. No. Earl Clark, I think, came along much later. Yeah, it was Take One Dean who set the screen. The star of that team was Francisco Garcia. They also had.
God, I hated him too.
Larry O'Bannon.
Well, he did a good job in getting NCAA football back. So,
wrong O'Bannon. Not even that family. Okay, let's wrap up by talking quickly about UW football.
We had more. Sorry, I thought we were done.
No,
that's why I was rambling. I thought you would cut all this off.
Which got another transfer. Cornerback Brendan Radley Hiles, a.k.a. Buki, announced his transfer to UW from Oklahoma. A 4-star recruit who started regularly during his 3 seasons with the Sooners, but struggled with high expectations and penalties, in particular personal fouls.
Do you think that B-O-O-K-I-E is pronounced Buki?
No, I don't actually think so. It should be Buki. Yes.
Okay. Yes.
Clearly.
Okay.
Look, sometimes you're reading things and you're just reading and you don't have time to think about it. Oklahoma coach Lincoln Riley passionately came to his defense in November, telling reporters, "I know Bookie's taken some grief. No question there's things he's got to be better. I would say too. Hopefully you guys will choose to write this as well. I don't know that we've got a bigger team player on this team than that guy." Radley Hiles' size at 5'9" essentially limits him to nickel back, where he'll presumably compete with Kyler Gordon, among others, to replace Elijah Molden. Gordon is also in the mix as a free safety and an outside corner, and I suppose it's possible a move to safety could be in store for Radley Hiles, who is known for his physical tackling at Oklahoma. He'll have 3 years to play two for the Huskies.
Fucking huge.
I will say, saying nothing about him individually, this is my single least favorite type of defensive football player.
I hate you so much. Oh my God.
The big hitter who constantly gets penalties is my single least favorite type of player.
You don't know about football. It's fine. You don't watch the games. I'm sorry, but like this is a bit, you have so little information to say that that's who this player is.
I perused some Oklahoma commentary. It wasn't the most positive.
I'll tell you, you get him into a Jimmy Lake system.
Yeah, and the Huskies,
Lincoln Riley doesn't care about that shit. Come on.
I mean, his quote indicated that he did in fact care about that shit. If you get him in the Huskies' emphasis on rugby tackling, I think the hope would be that could clean up some of the issues with personal fouls. But you know, I do think expectations should probably be tempered to some extent. In fact, expectations should just always be tempered.
I refuse.
It's always a good
thing.
In
fact, I refuse to temper expectations.
Oh no!
possibly a Heisman candidate.
I mean, look. Wow, your bold predictions indicate your unwillingness to temper expectations, and it has not worked out great for you.
What? What are you talking? Okay.
Who were the Seahawks going to play in the Super Bowl this year?
Oh, don't worry about it.
I mean, that's the thing is, by the way, the Seahawks went all in on a season where they lost in the fucking first round.
Oh
of the
my
playoffs.
God, I'm so annoyed about it. I'm just like, that's the thing about this offseason that people don't bring up enough is that. It's just really fucking annoying that they went all in. And look, I like Jamal Adams, right? But the Jamal Adams trade was such a massive fuck up that I feel like people, when they talk about free agency, instead of talking about what the Seahawks are doing, should just be like, the Seahawks massively fucked up last year by trading for Jamal Adams and lost in the first round. And that's why they're in this bullshit situation.
Oh, and then they alienated their star quarterback. Good times.
Football is, for lack of a better word, the worst. It was funny. Jan was telling me she was talking about like what she would do if Russell Wilson was traded, which I thought was really weird. She was like, "I would just collapse to the ground and not be able to move." I was like, "You can't." I was like, "I don't. I'd probably just carry on with my life. I don't know what to say. Like, I'd be upset about the Seahawks trading Russell Wilson, but I don't know how there came to be a time that I have more going on in my life than Jan does that I'm so unconcerned. I'm like,
which is retired during a pandemic. I think it makes sense. I think that actually checks out.
She's like, all I have is to pay attention to the Seahawks. And I'm like, I just don't. I know for a fact that you cannot feel the feelings that I feel during a Seahawks game because you routinely miss most Seahawks games.
You never get so angry that you yell at yourself during Seahawks games when you happen to come over.
If I miss a single snap of a Seahawks game, it's like an issue for me. But Jan would throw herself on the ground and be so upset if they trade. And I think the reality is like I can conceive a world that Russell Wilson is not the Seahawks quarterback because I actually was a fan of the Seahawks before Russell Wilson was the quarterback.
Now that's fair.
For Jan, it would actually be the first time that she was a fan of the Seahawks when Russell Wilson wasn't a quarterback, and for much of the fan base, of course.
I will admit, I would probably be unable to sleep because I would be so angry. I would get sick to my stomach. But, you know, that sometimes happens just because the Blazers don't end up playing to the Jazz in the first round of the playoffs.
Is that a callback to, like, years ago?
I don't think we discussed it on the pod. I don't know
you
if it's a callback.
You
couldn't
sleep because they played the wrong team. Was that because the fucking Anfernee Simons game where he went off? Oh,
yeah.
My God. Didn't they make? Was that the year they made the Western Conference Finals?
It was, yeah. They ended up beating the Thunder.
So what are you bothered by?
Well, I didn't know that was going to happen at the time.
Blazers playoff run since Clyde Drexler. I was on a Zoom call with a record label from Portland, and I was like, you know what the worst fucking thing about this is that I can't go to Portland to go to a Blazers playoff game this year. And I wanted him to give me the Blazers love in response, and he was just like, yeah, okay. And I was like,
oh, wow. I mean, are you allowed to be from Portland and not
I was like,
care
I
about
don't
the Blazers?
I think you might be from Portland, Maine.
Oh, no.
Sorry. Well, no, I think he is a Blazers fan. But I was ready to go deep. I was ready for him to be like, you know what? If it weren't for this Nurk injury, we'd be number one in the West. I was ready to just derail the entire Zoom conversation with all the other people there and get deep on the Blazers.
Did you see my stat on the Blazers?
No, let's see it.
And I was 6-1 in games decided by 1 or 2 points this season.
I was thinking about that watching the end of this game of like they always end up in these ridiculous scenarios. Like this year, where the ball just was that Eric Bledsoe or is that Nah?
Oh, it was the ball. Nah.
Okay. Yeah. Like, I feel like that happens to the Blazers more than other teams where the ball hilariously bounces off of them. And even the refs calling the foul on that play, like, that's not a foul. It was a foul. I don't think it was a bad call, but, like, that's not a foul that gets called that often.
It's not an automatic thing in that situation.
And the fact that they called it, I was even nervous that Dame was going to miss one of those free throws, too.
I mean, I thought Zion might hit that shot at the end of the game.
Oh my God, it was so close. If that, I in fact, if Zion would have hit that shot, I would have straight up, I'm going to bring this full circle for you. I would have straight up Jan style collapsed to the ground, upset about that Blazers loss. So look, maybe I understand Jan after all, because this would have been a fucking Tuesday night in March loss. When I was looking at the schedule, I was like, damn, the Blazers have a lot of games left to go. Normally this would be near the end of the season, but there's just games. So I would, but because of a loss to the Pelicans in March, that I feel like the Blazers, clearly they should have lost. I'd already given up on the game and then came back to it because you fucking chatted me. I would have collapsed to the ground if Zion hit that shot at the end of the game.
On that note,
we're still podcasting?
Yeah.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.